Greetings from Church of the Resurrection, and thank you for taking time to listen to this message. We hope you find this message meaningful and relevant. We invite you to join us in worship at any time. We're located just south of 135th Street between Rowe and Nall Avenue in Leawood, Kansas. If you have any questions or comments, or you would like a DVD of the service, you may reach us by phone at 913-897-0120. Please ask for the Well Bookstore or visit our website at www.cor.org, where you will find a link for our catalog. And now, may you be blessed as you give attention to the reading of God's Word.
I would invite you to stand as you are able to honor the reading of the Scripture taken from Mark chapter 15, verses 25 through 39. It was 9 o'clock in the morning when they crucified him. The inscription of the charge against him read, "The King of the Jews." And with him they crucified two bandits, one on his right and one on his left. Those who passed by derided him, shaking their heads and saying, "Aha! You who would destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself and come down now from the cross." In the way, the chief priest, along with the scribes, were also mocking him among themselves and saying, "He saved others, he cannot save himself. Let the Messiah, the King of Israel, come down from the cross now, so that we may see and believe." Those who were crucified with him also taunted him. When it was noon, darkness came over the whole land, until 3 in the afternoon. At 3 o'clock, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, "Eli, Eli, lema sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you forsaken me?" When some of the bystanders heard it, they said, "Listen, he is calling for Elijah." And someone ran, filled a sponge with sour wine, put it on a stick, and gave it to him to drink, saying, "Wait, let us see whether Elijah will come to take him down." Then Jesus gave a loud cry and breathed his last. And the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. And when the centurion who stood facing him saw that in this way he had breathed his last, he said, "Truly, this man was God's son." May God's blessing be added to the reading, hearing, and understanding of the word. Please be seated.
Today we reach the tragic climax of the 24 hours that changed the world. Over the last 6 weeks for the season of Lent, we have been walking with Jesus, beginning on Thursday, his Passover Seder at 6 p.m., and then to the Garden of Gethsemane, and then his arrest and trial before the Sanhedrin, and then his trial before Pontius Pilate, the flogging at the hands of the Roman soldiers, and his mocking as they plaited a crown of thorns and placed it upon his brow. But today at 8:30 in the morning on that Friday morning, we remember today those events. We remember how Jesus was led out by the Roman soldiers and taken to be crucified. My aim is to help you see that, to help you see the crucifixion in ways perhaps you've not seen it before, to hear the story of what happened to Jesus and what he said and what he did from the cross. And then finally to ask this question, what does this mean for me? What does this have to do with us today? Now, I want to begin by recognizing that Roman crucifixion was not designed to expeditiously put to death criminals. In fact, it was just the opposite. It was designed to prolong their agony for as long as possible, to make them suffer for as long as possible. And it was to take place at a busy intersection outside of the city walls so that as many people might see it as possible, so that the people in that town would look at those who were suffering and say, I will never, ever do what that person did because I never, ever want that to happen to me. Over hundreds of years, the Romans had perfected the process of tormenting people and keeping them alive for as long as possible. And the process represented human beings at their very worst. Now, there are several things that I learned about crucifixion over the last few years I'd like to share with you today. And one of them I just learned this week. I had not known this before, that the sign that went above the victim's head, if it was the form of cross in which a sign could be placed there, before it was attached to the cross, was actually a rope was attached and it was put around the neck of the one who was sentenced to die. So when Jesus and the other convicts were sentenced by Pontius Pilate, the sign that would name their crime was affixed around their necks as they prepared to carry their cross to the place of crucifixion. Now, for the other two, the sign merely read robber or bandit. For Jesus, it was perplexing what to put on the sign exactly. He wasn't a murderer. He wasn't a thief, a rapist. He didn't even lead an armed rebellion against the Roman Empire. And so Pontius Pilate merely had written there, Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews. Upon arriving at the site of crucifixion, the sign would be taken off and then affixed above the head of the victim. There were some crosses, the Roman tau, which was just like a capital T with no place above the head. And so in those cases, the victim continued to wear the sign naming their crime. It was called a titlos. Continued to wear the sign naming their crime as they hung there on the cross. Well, as Jesus was sent to be crucified, he and the other two criminals were made to carry their own crosses. This was common Roman practice. And the idea was to have the victim that was about to be crucified on that piece of wood to actually have to carry it next to their face, to carry it on their shoulders with them on the way to crucifixion. It was to inflict additional mental anguish upon the one being crucified. Now, John's gospel tells us that Jesus carried the cross. Matthew, Mark, and Luke's gospel tell us that a man named Simon from Cyrene, northern Libya, a Jew who was in Jerusalem for the Passover, was forced to carry the cross for Christ. Which was it? Well, it was, of course, probably both of those. You remember that just before Jesus was made to carry the cross, he was beaten nearly to death by the Romans. And then he was mocked, a crown of thorns upon his brow, and then finally he was dressed in his own clothes once more, and now he was to carry the cross. Let me just remind you of a few things I've taught you before about the Roman crosses. There were two pieces to the Roman cross. The stipes was the vertical element. It was typically left in place at the site of crucifixion. The patibula was the horizontal element, and it's this that was carried by the victims of crucifixion. I know most of us have it that they carried the entire cross. The cross weighed 300 pounds. It took three strong men last year when we put it together to carry it from the back of the room to the front here in our sanctuary. There's no way a human being was going to carry that by themselves to the place of crucifixion. Now, there was no reason to take the 200-pound stipes back and forth. It was only the patibula that was taken. And so a strong man could pick up the patibula and carry it for a distance. This would weigh between 75 and 100 pounds. Last year, LaVon and I decided to walk in the footsteps of Jesus from the place that he was sentenced to die to the place of his crucifixion. We were in Jerusalem. And the distance was about a third of a mile. It's not very far. If here at our central sanctuary, it's from here to Ted's Montana Grill. And a strong man could carry 100 pounds on his back that far, unless he'd been beaten nearly to death just before. And I don't understand any way Jesus could have carried this a third of a mile. And so he took the cross upon his shoulder, felt it next to his chin. He carried it as far as he could, and then when he couldn't carry it any further, it was picked up by Simon of Cyrene. An interruption in his day, an inconvenience, actually a horrifying one. But he picked up the cross, and he carried it for Jesus. And there's significant evidence that Simon of Cyrene stood there the rest of the day watching Jesus die, and afterwards became a follower of Christ himself. So Jesus carried the cross as far as he could. It was picked up by Simon of Cyrene and then carried to Golgotha, to Calvary, to the place of the skull. Ron, would you come and help me? The stipes then would have been taken down if it was left erect on the site of crucifixion, taken down, and the cross would have been assembled in that place. Jesus would have been brought by the Romans. There were four of them, Roman soldiers, who were assigned the task of crucifying criminals. Jesus would have been brought. The cross would have been assembled. He would have been laid flat on the cross, his feet straddling either side to give him balance, and his arms taken and then nailed to the top of the cross. Now, we often picture his hands being nailed to the cross, but remember that the weight of the victim had to be supported by these nails and by the body. The hands can't support that weight. The nails were driven actually through the wrist, and these bones are capable of supporting the weight of the victim who is being crucified. And so care was taken to not pierce the vein that sits here and to touch the nerve that sits here. And so what resulted was what might be considered excruciating pain from the nerve that passes here. Excruciating from the Latin word for crucifixion. Now, once the hands were nailed in place, the victim's feet would be nailed to the cross. Now, we always pictured from art the feet of Jesus like this on the front of the cross, and one nail piercing both feet and holding them in place. And that's what most people had thought for generations, until 1968, when a bone box, an ossuary, was found in Jerusalem, and inside was something archaeologists had never seen before, and that was the bones of a person who was crucified with the nail still in the bones. You'll see the image here on the video screen. On the right is the fragment of the heel with the nail still piercing it. And between the head of the nail and the bone, there is a fragment of wood, olive wood, which tells us that wood was nailed first, and then the nail was driven through the heel, and then the wood helped keep the victim's feet against the cross firmly in place. You'll see then the model on the left-hand side of what that would have looked like. Now, what that led people to believe was that the victim was crucified. So from 1968 until the mid-1990s, it was thought that one nail then pierced both heels from the side, and the victim was still nailed their feet to the front of the cross. And so you'll often see drawings that look like this from the 1980s and 1990s of what a crucifixion would have looked like. But then the scholars went back and they re-examined that nail. And what they found was that the nail was only 5 inches long. And a 5-inch nail wasn't long enough to penetrate two heels and then to and the piece of wood and to firmly keep the legs of the victim in place on the cross. And so they began to rethink this, and they realized that the legs were actually nailed in the side of the cross, not in the front of the cross, as you see in this sketch. Do we have the artist rendering? Now, Jesus, of course, was crucified naked. The aim was to humiliate and shame the victims of crucifixion as well as to inflict physical torture on them. But you see the legs straddling the cross, nailed in on either side. So when Jesus was nailed to the cross, his hands and his feet were nailed firmly in place. And then the cross was erected, Ron. Like this. Four Roman soldiers lifting the cross with the victim in place. In this case, Jesus raised. And now gravity took over. This was the interesting device that the Romans had discovered, was that as the victim hung on the cross, let me place the crown of thorns here so you can visualize where Jesus' head would have been. As the victim hung on the cross, two things happened. One is the pain became almost unbearable on the wrists as their body was pulled down by the weight of gravity. The other thing that happened was that as their body sunk down into this position, it became harder and harder to breathe. You could breathe in, but you couldn't breathe out. And so to breathe out, to exhale, you had to raise yourself up on the nails in your hands, breathe out, and then sink back down to breathe in. And so for hours, the victim of crucifixion was raising and lowering themselves on the cross in order simply to breathe. Now, we asked Rich Richardson, the head of emergency medicine for Johnson County, to reflect upon how those who were crucified would eventually expire, how they died. Remember, they could hang on the cross, some of them for days. In Jesus' case, it was 6 hours. And this is how Rich described the likely causes of death. Take a listen.
It is unlikely that there is just one cause for Jesus' death. We know that there is asphyxiation, that he would suffocate. As his arms are suspended, that pulls his ribs open, and he is caught in a perpetual inhalation. The problem is he cannot get his air out. And so he could not catch his breath. If he tried to pull up to catch his breath, then once again that would cause more pain. The second reason that he would die would be from hypovolemic shock or massive blood loss. There's just not enough blood to circulate to carry oxygen. And what blood did make, it didn't have any oxygen because he could not breathe. The third belief is congestive heart failure, that the heart was so wounded, so weakened, that fluid starts to build up in the lungs and around the heart, so the heart cannot compress or open and close, pump adequately. So it was probably a combination of those three that caused his death.
One other thing that I would remind you of, for those of you who have been here for any length of time, you know, we often picture Jesus hanging on the cross 15 or 20 feet in the air. I mean, even Gibson's Passion of the Christ showed the crosses way up here. But in fact, the Roman crosses were seldom more than 6 to 9 feet tall from the ground to the top of the cross. And so this would have been the approximate dimensions of Jesus' cross. And when Jesus hung here, Pastor Karen, would you come over here for a moment? As Jesus hung on the cross, this was his approximate relationship to those who were on the ground. His mother who stood there at the foot of the cross weeping, the Roman guards and the chief priests and the passers-by who all insulted and hurled derisions at him. Mary, if you could just reach out your hand, Mary could have nearly touched the face of Jesus as he hung on the cross. And when Jesus cried out for God to forgive those who were taunting him, he was looking at them in the eyes. This was the relationship he had. Thank you, Karen. That changes how you read the story. All of these people could hear what Jesus was saying from the cross. He was able to look them in the eyes. They were able to look at him. They spat upon him. They hurled insults at him. Now, this week, I came in the sanctuary when the cross was set up here for a few moments, and I thought, I just want to put my hands where his hands would have been, and I want to spend a few moments in prayer and just see how long can I pray in a position like this. And my hands weren't nailed here. I was standing on a stool. And after 10 minutes, I found my arms began to grow weary, and I began to feel the pain. Jesus hung here for 6 hours. I'd like for us to focus for a few moments on what Jesus actually said from the cross. And this would require far more than one 30-minute sermon to cover. And so I've covered much of it in the devotional book. If you're reading that, I hope that you'll continue to read this week. But I would like to cover the 7 last words of Jesus. And they weren't actually words, they were 7 statements or phrases, 7 things that Jesus said from the cross as he was dying over those 6 hours. And I'm grateful that we have 4 Gospels because each one records something different. Matthew and Mark record much the same thing. Luke and John tell us different things. And undoubtedly, all of those 7 statements were made from the cross. And we're going to focus on just 2 of them today. But let's recount all of them briefly. We remember that in Luke's gospel, we read that Jesus looked upon those who hung him on the cross. He looked upon those who were casting insults at him, the thief on either side, the Roman soldiers, those who were gambling for his clothing at his feet, indifferent to his suffering, the chief priests and the passersby. He looked at all of them, and then he began to pray. Jesus, in his suffering, began to pray, and this is what he prayed. Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. You know, there's a lot of folks who like to talk about the wrath of God and God's anger against sinful people. But what's interesting in Jesus is we get a different picture. It's not that there's not such a thing as the wrath of God, but here, if there was ever a time when God in flesh, that is Jesus, the Son of God, if there was ever a time that you would expect him to be wrathful, it would be here. But instead what he does is he prays for those who have done this to him. I've met with some of you from time to time who have said, Pastor Adam, I've never told anybody this before, and then you confess some dark secret. And from time to time I've had people say, and I can't imagine that God could ever forgive me for this. Listen, none of you has physically nailed Jesus to the cross and then continued to cast insults at him. But even if you had, Jesus would be praying, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. That's a picture of mercy. And if God in flesh, if Jesus, the Son of God, would ask for the Father to forgive these people who'd done this to him, he is willing and able to forgive you. We turn from Luke's gospel to John's gospel. At the foot of the cross stands Mary and the Apostle John. And Mary, of course, as you can imagine, is weeping as she watches her son writhe in pain. For 6 hours she stands there, helpless to do anything. And Jesus looks down upon her, and though he's in the midst of his own tremendous suffering, he looks at her, and then he looks at John, and he says this, Woman, here now is your son. And looking at John, he said, Here is your mother. Despite his own suffering and pain, the issues that he was facing on the cross, he's still concerned for his mother and her well-being after he's gone. There's a whole sermon that could be preached just about that. Matthew and Mark record the next words of Jesus. And here once more he's praying. Only this time he's praying one of the Psalms. And as he hangs there on the cross, having hung there for now hours, he cries out these words, so sorrowful. My God, why have you forsaken me? There are Christians who are troubled by hearing Jesus say those things from the cross. They want to come up with all kinds of reasons to explain away the agony of Jesus. But I find those words very comforting. The fact that God, when he walked in human flesh on this earth, understood what it was like to feel complete despair. That God the Son experienced a sense that the Father was nowhere to be found, that he was not listening, he was not present, he was not helping, he had disappeared from his life. And so God was conspicuous by his absence, he was deafening by his silence. And every single one of us will walk through a period in our lives where we experience the same thing. And so we know when we pray to Jesus, he understands what it's like to feel this way. He knew with his head that God had not abandoned him, but in his heart, this is what he felt. Very, very alone. He experienced what we experience. We'll ponder this more on Thursday at the Maundy-Thursday service this week. What happens next is found in John's gospel. And it's a very human scene in which Jesus, having hung on the cross now perhaps 4 hours, already dehydrated from having been beaten and abused, trying to breathe up and down, breathing, he cries out simply, I thirst. I thirst. Now, we understand physically that he was thirsting, but John, in telling us this, is pointing towards a whole wealth of other ideas. And I want to ponder this one for just a moment. First, the idea of just his physical thirst. I have been with a number of different people as they were approaching death, and if that struggle with death had been coming for hours, inevitably, they're thirsty. And I remember with Pastor Ray Firestone, who was a part of our team before his passing, I went to see him at his home, and he had a glass of water there, and he turned to me and he said, it was actually Holy Week. And he turned to me and he said, Adam, I'm thirsty. And I took a straw and I dipped it in a cup of water and put my finger on the end of the straw and then lifted the straw up and gently let the water flow into his mouth. This last week, I stopped by to see one of our older members who had a terrible fall, and I think he's going to be okay, but at the time, his life was hanging in the balance, and I walked into the room and greeted him, and he said, Adam, I'm thirsty, and the doctors had left a cup with water and one of these little sticks with a sponge on the end, and I gently dipped it in the water and placed it to his lips so that he could draw the water from it. Jesus said, I thirst, and someone ran, and they found a branch and attached a sponge to the branch and dipped it in wine vinegar and sour wine, and they took it to Jesus, and they held it up to his lips so that he could draw some of the wine vinegar into his mouth. Now, when we read this in Matthew and Mark and in John's gospel, this is an act of compassion. But in John's gospel, it's even more than that. You have to remember in John's gospel, Jesus had waited for a woman at a well in Samaria. And when she came there, he said, "Give me a drink." And then when she did, he said, "If you were to ask of me, I would give you living water and you would never be thirsty again." And John, by telling us, Jesus says, "I thirst," is saying the source of living water itself is drying up on the cross. You remember that Jesus changed water into wine in John's gospel, and the finest wine. But what was given him while he hangs on the cross is the bitter wine, the sour wine. More than that, though, John tells us a detail that the other gospel writers don't tell us. Matthew and Mark, they tell us a sponge was affixed to a stick. Only John tells us that the stick was a branch of hyssop. Now, that seems like an insignificant piece of information. Why would John tell us what kind of branch they attached the sponge to? But in John's gospel, and reading it, anytime you find a piece of seemingly insignificant information, just as sort of like, why is he telling us this? You better ask that question really carefully, because it's always pointing towards a deeper meaning. Hyssop. Hyssop was from the mint family. And it was a small bush, had flowers that looked like lavender. And so when you study in the Bible what hyssop meant, just remind you of a couple of the things. We learned that at the Passover, when the Jews were in Egypt enslaved, God had sent plague after plague upon the Egyptians so that they would let the Israelites go free, and they refused. And so God said to Moses, "Tonight I'm going to send a plague that will cause them to beg you to leave this land. And this very night I will set you free from slavery. I'll send a plague of death through the land, and the firstborn child in every Egyptian home will perish this night. Now, this is what you're to do to protect your own children. You're to slaughter a lamb, catch the blood in a basin. You're to prepare the lamb for a meal, a final meal here in this land. And then you're to take a branch of hyssop, and you're to dip it in the blood of the lamb, and you're to mark the doorpost and the lintels. And when the angel of death passes through the land, he will see the markings from the hyssop, the blood of the lamb, and he will pass over your homes, and your children will be spared death, and you will be set free from slavery." What do you think John was trying to tell us was happening on the cross when he tells us that hyssop was being used to lift up the wine to Jesus? Except that Jesus came to be our liberator, to set us free from all that enslaves us, and he came to set us free from death. Now, that's not all that we read about hyssop in the Old Testament. We also read that when an individual became ritually unclean or impure, they were to go to the priest, and the priest was to take a branch of hyssop, dip it in water, and then sprinkle the individual with water, with prayers, and those who were unclean would become clean or ritually pure. What do you think he was saying that Jesus was doing for us in describing hyssop as the branch that was lifted up, but that Jesus came to purify us and make us clean? And you know, sometimes the prescription was to mix blood and water together in certain situations and sprinkle that. And do you remember? Only John's gospel tells us that after Jesus died, a spear was used to pierce his side, and from that side flowed what? Blood and water. Do you see what he's trying to teach us is happening here? That Jesus' death was about setting you free from what enslaves you. He was the liberator. He was the one who gives us the hope of everlasting life, and he was the one who purifies and cleanses us from all unrighteousness. We return to Luke's gospel. And in Luke's gospel, we read this happened. One of the criminals who were hanged there kept deriding him and saying, "Are you not the Messiah? Save yourself and us." But the other rebuked this thief, saying, "Do you not fear God, since you were under the same sentence of condemnation? And we indeed have been condemned justly, for we are getting what we deserve for our deeds, but this man has done nothing wrong." Then he said, "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom." And Jesus replied, now the fifth phrase from the cross, "Truly I tell you, today you will be with me in paradise." Two things to notice from this. The first is that the thief on the cross who turned to Jesus, all he said, he was a thief who had been deriding Jesus, but having watched Jesus suffer, having listened to his words, he finally found himself convicted, and he turned to Jesus and he said, simply, "Remember me." I want to ask you this question. Do you think this man on the cross who Jesus promised paradise to, do you think he understood the doctrine of the Trinity? Do you think he understood the right doctrine of the atonement? Do you think he understood the dual natures of Jesus? Jesus was fully God and fully human. Do you think he had a particular view of the Bible and its inerrancy and infallibility? Do you think he was baptized in a certain way or baptized at all? Do you think he took communion in a certain way or worshiped with a certain kind of music? Do you think he was a Methodist? Was he a Baptist, Pentecostal, Roman Catholic, Orthodox? Of course, he was none of those things. And he didn't understand all of those things. I'm not saying doctrine's not important, but listen. We as Christians have this terrible tendency to want to exclude everybody who doesn't see things just like we do. If you don't have your theological ducks in a row in just a certain way, then you can't be going to heaven. If you're not a member of this particular church or you don't receive communion in this way, you're not going to go to heaven. Tell that to the thief on the cross. Tell that to Jesus, who turned to a man who didn't understand any of those things and simply said, because he said, remember me, Jesus said, today you'll be with me in paradise. Doctrine is really important. But what saves us, what redeems us, is Christ's grace and our faith. Simply turning to God, even if we don't have it all figured out. God's mercy is far wider than most people can see. The last thing to note about this is that when Jesus was hanging on the cross, you know, his passion in his ministry was finding non-religious and nominally religious people. He said, I came to seek and to save those who are lost. And while he's hanging on the cross, he's still inviting people into Christ's kingdom, into God's kingdom. That was his passion, to find people who had messed up in their lives and turned away from God and to bring them back to God. The last two phrases I'll mention just briefly. Jesus, as he's hanging on the cross in Luke's gospel, says this as the sixth statement. He says, Father, into thy hands I commend my spirit. We call these breath prayers. They're prayers that are so short you can say them. You just take one breath in and you can say it in one breath. Father, into thy hands I commend my spirit. I'd suggest this. This is a great prayer for you to memorize and say every day. Jesus wondered if God had abandoned him. Nevertheless, he prayed, Father, into thy hands I commend my spirit. An act of faith at the very end, I give myself wholly to you, O God. I trust myself to you. What would happen if every morning you woke up and got to your knees and simply said, Father, into thy hands I commend my spirit. Every night before you went to bed, before you went to sleep, Father, into thy hands I commend my spirit. Every time you're in a mountaintop experience and life's going so well you tend to forget about God, you remember to stop and say, Father, into thy hands I commend my spirit. And when you're walking through hell on earth, to stop and say once more, Father, into thy hands I commend my spirit. As I was reflecting upon this week, I began thinking, I pray that when I approach death, I have the presence of mind, if I can't remember anything else, that I might remember to make this my final words on this earth, Father, into thy hands I commend my spirit. Matthew and Mark tell us that Jesus died with a shout, but don't tell us what he said. John tells us what he said. There's one word in Greek, three in English. It is finished. The word in Greek isn't just like it's sort of done. It's completed. It's something that Jesus was sent to do, and it's been finished. This isn't the cry of defeat. This is a shout of victory. What I came to do, I did. It is finished. What did he come to do? He came to save us. To save us from whatever we need to be saved from. And when we begin to ponder this, the whole story of the last 24 hours was meant to show us that there's something dreadfully wrong with humanity. There's something dreadfully wrong that leads people to put other people on a cross, or leads the criminals on either side to cast dispersion, or for those at the ground watching a man suffer not to have compassion, but instead to continue to feel hatred in their hearts. There's something not quite right, and we find ourselves separated from God. And when we talk about what Jesus was doing, we use the word atonement, at-one-ment, that Jesus came at God's initiative to draw us back into right relationship with God, because the things in our lives tend to separate us from God. The struggles we have psychologically, emotionally, and the spiritual struggles that we face with sin, all of these things separate us from God, and God is not content to have us be separated from him. But instead, God takes the initiative to do whatever is necessary to save us from ourselves and from sin, from death, from hopelessness and despair, and all of the other things in the human condition that bring darkness into our lives. Jesus came to save us from these things. Now, when it comes to Jesus' suffering and death on the cross and how that works, a friend of mine who's in his 70s said recently to me, you know, Adam, I've been a Christian all my life. I trust that Jesus died for me, but I can't begin to explain to you how that works. I don't really fully understand how this works. I appreciated the fact that he'd say that because that's honest. And the truth is, if you think you have it all figured out, you don't have a big enough picture of what was happening on the cross. I have dozens of books. These are just four of them right here, devoted entirely to the atonement and trying to make sense of it and understand it. The best theological minds don't fully comprehend what the atonement was about. We tend to latch on to one explanation of what Jesus was doing on the cross, and we miss out on the multitude of things that God was doing. And as I've looked at the cross over the last 30 years, I've come to understand for myself that Jesus, who spoke in parables throughout his life, and you remember a parable was a story that was meant to sort of wash over you. It had one central point, and when you got it, man, you were meant to get it. But if you asked too many questions of the parable, it began to break down at some point. You were not meant to ask lots of questions. You were meant to understand the main idea. It struck me one year as I was pondering the cross that Jesus was preaching a parable from the cross with his own flesh and blood. He was preaching a parable that was meant to have not just one central idea, or maybe it was the reconciliation of humanity with God, but multiple ways of understanding that. And so the various theories of the atonement, you know, one of them will be exactly what you need today, but tomorrow you may need a different way of understanding what the cross was about. It is medicine for our souls to heal us. It is a bridge by which we are reconciled to God, but it's not meant to be understood mechanistically. Instead, we understand it is a picture, different pictures of what the cross means, so of what Jesus does to atone for us. So when we began this sermon series, we talked about Jesus as the Passover lamb who sets us free from what enslaves us and who offers us freedom from death. In the second week, we talked about Jesus as the second Adam who in the Garden of Gethsemane reversed what Adam had done in the Garden of Eden, where Adam had prayed, not thy will, but my will be done. In the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus, the second Adam, prayed, not my will, but thy will be done. We talked about Jesus as the substitute for us, who takes upon himself the punishment that we deserve. And then we talked about Jesus as the one who atones for us morally, who by the suffering of an innocent man compels us to want to live differently in the future. All of these are different ways of understanding the atonement. And today I'd mention one more, and that is the idea that Jesus is making an offering for you, a peace offering for you, for all of humanity. You know, when you've done something wrong to somebody else, you try to make amends. You do that by writing an apology letter. You tell them you're sorry. You let them see just how bad you feel about that. And the more serious the crime, the infraction, the more serious the efforts have to be at trying to make amends. I mean, if you've just got a spat with your spouse, roses and chocolates may be fine. But if you violated the covenant of your marriage, it's going to take more than that. And so when Jesus came, one way of understanding, one of many ways of understanding the atonement, is he was offering himself to God on behalf of humankind. The high priest, their job was to atone for the sins of people. People brought their sacrifices to God, their offerings to God. It wasn't about the punishment being put on the offering, though that was one way to understand it. It was about the offering saying on behalf of the one offering it, God, I love you and I am sorry for what I've done and I give you this. This means something to me and I give it to you as a way of saying, I really want to be right with you. Jesus was the high priest and the sacrifice. And he offers himself to God. He says to the Father, Father, I offer you all that I am for humankind. I offer you my very life, Father, out of love for these people. It was God's way of showing to all the rest of us the price that he was willing to pay to save us and redeem us, the costliness of his grace. It wasn't just saying, it's okay, you're forgiven. Your forgiveness came at the price of a man who loved you and gave himself for you. So when we get to Ephesians, we read Paul saying, live in love as Christ loved us and gave himself up for us, a fragrant offering and sacrifice to God. That is not about punishment. That is about an offering made to God on our behalf, an offering you can't afford, but he could afford and he gave for you. It's a demonstration of his love so that Jesus says, greater love has no one than this, that they lay down their life for their friends. And the Apostle Paul says this, God proved his love for us in this, that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. So one way of understanding the cross is Jesus offering himself as an expression to you of the depth of God's love for you, that your life is worth saving, and as a way of expressing to the Father, I give everything for these people. I have two daughters, Danielle and Rebecca, and I've told them many, many times, girls, I want you to know that your daddy loves you so much. If there came a moment where somebody had to die to save you, I would give my life to save you. If you needed an organ, if there was somebody going to kill somebody and somebody had to die, I'm going to stand in front of you. I love you so much, I would give my life for you. I want you to know that you are loved that much. Every parent would say that to their children. This is what God said in Jesus Christ to you. I end with these last two details. When Jesus breathed his last, a half a mile away in the temple, something happened. The inner court of the temple, the inner sanctum, was called the Holy of Holies, and that's where the throne room of God was, and it's where the priest went once a year to atone for the sins of the people. And there was a curtain that separated the Holy of Holies from the rest of the temple. It was 60 feet high and 30 feet wide and 4 inches thick. And when Jesus breathed his last, something strange and perplexing began to happen. That curtain, that veil, began to tear apart from top to bottom, leaving open the throne room of God. What do you think that detail was meant to teach you about what Jesus had done in breaking down the wall that separates us from God and bringing us to God? And this is the last detail. And this has to do with your response. There were 4 soldiers at the foot of the cross gambling for Jesus' clothing. One of them watched for 6 hours and heard every word Jesus said. And the gospel writers tell us that after seeing this man suffer, he turned to Jesus after he had died and said, "Surely this was the Son of God." 2 criminals hung on crosses either side of Jesus. One continued to hurl insults at Jesus, and the other one said, "Remember me when you come into your kingdom." And Simon of Cyrene interrupted, forced to carry the cross of Jesus, after watching him for 6 hours, became a follower of Jesus Christ. His children became leaders in the church at Rome. And my question of you is, I've spent 6 weeks trying to show you the suffering of Jesus. I wanted you to see it and understand that he gave himself for you. What will your response be? And my hope and prayer is that you look at this cross and you see Jesus, and you might say with Isaac Watts, "When I survey the wondrous cross on which the Prince of Glory died, my richest gain I count but loss and pour contempt on all my pride. Were the whole realm of nature mine, that were a present far too small, love so amazing, so divine, demands my soul, my life, my all." That's my hope. That you might see him and give your life to him. Would you bow in prayer with me? And while your heads are bowed and your eyes are closed, I'd like to invite you. Christ died for you. He suffered to bring you into right relationship with his Father. He bore upon the cross your sins. He came to set you free from whatever enslaves you. He offers you freedom from death, an entrance into his eternal kingdom and paradise. All of this he came to do. And it cost him his life. What will you do with the crucified Jesus? My invitation for you is to simply say yes to him. So if today you'd like to commit your life to Christ or renew your faith in him, would you simply pray this quietly under your breath? You don't even have to say it loud enough for anyone to hear but God. But would you pray this prayer quietly with me? Thank you, Jesus, for what you've done for me. I receive the gift of your salvation. Forgive my sins. Wash me clean and make me new. And help me to follow you. Into your hands, O Father, I commend my spirit. Lord, bless all of these, your people, and help us to walk with you and to carry the cross. In Jesus' name, amen.